Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. I'm David Noble in Dalgety Bay, in Scotland as ever, joined first time in a wee while by John Johnson, my co-host, and this evening we're delighted to welcome as our guest Angela McFarlane, who is the CEO of the College of Teachers, which is based in the Institute of Education in central London. Good evening, Angela. Welcome to Radio Edutalk.
Hello, David. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Okay. And over the next half an hour or so, we're going to be hearing about Angela's book, which came out recently, Authentic Learning for the Digital Generation, and also a couple of other things around to do with work that the College of Teachers is involved in presently, and also about something that John and I are trying to work out what it might be. It's hashtag Claim Your College. Angela, just to start off with, could you give us a kind of background to your career in universities and in education and public sector more widely?
Well, we'll have to be a bit careful, David, that we don't take up the whole hour, half hour on that.
Of course.
Because I've been around a while now. But briefly, I trained as a bioscientist, and that's what my PhD's in. And then I was a secondary school teacher for 5 years and ended up as a head of department and comprehensive in Hertfordshire before going to Homerton College in Cambridge, where I had a very happy dozen years working with the team. We spent a lot of time developing educational software and also doing various research and evaluation. But that's when I really got into technology-enhanced learning, as it would now be called. Having had, in my first school, I actually bought the very first computer. And I remember as a trainee teacher in a school in Bushey in Hertfordshire, having to go very diplomatically to the head of maths to beg to be allowed to have a bit of time on the research machine's 380Z with my lower set, what would now be year eight, which was an unheard of thing to do. So I've been sort of playing around with computers in the classroom for a very long time now. And following the time at Homerton, I went off and spent a year working with Bechtel, if you remember them, helping them set up their evidence and practice directorate. They were, at the time, the government agency across the UK. And in fact, I had a very pleasurable time because one of my responsibilities was to be the Bechtel liaison with colleagues in Scotland. So I had some very productive time working with Teaching and Learning Scotland and various other colleagues in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And then I went to take up a chair in education at Bristol and spent another decade there researching and teaching and doing a lot of relatively long-scale studies for the area. Technology-enhanced learning research tends not to be over a very long time. Often, a lot of the research is done on fairly early implementation of new technologies, and I was fortunate enough to have a number of projects. And those are the projects that have really contributed to the book, because the work that I did there was really in three areas. One was looking at game-based learning. The other was looking at learning in online communities, particularly informal online communities, which does have some overlap with the gaming work, actually, as well. The last project that I had, we followed a cohort of youngsters in the Midlands and in Bristol who had powerful connected personal devices. And we followed some of those for a total of 4 years, which was interesting because we took them through the end of primary and into transitioning into their secondary school. And so those three sets of studies are really the core of what's gone into the Authentic Learning book, all the learnings that I have to say that really what's the value of the book, such as it is, really comes from the fantastic teachers and students and fellow colleagues and researchers who all worked on those projects and all contributed to the content that's gone into the book.
Thanks very much, Angela. And I'll just say that if you are listening to the live stream, you can get in touch with Angela in two ways over the next wee while. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, @hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, just pop something up with the hashtag edutalk. So maybe just starting off with, if don't mind me picking one at random, Angela, you know the online learning communities and the game-based learning. Can you just take us through some of the kind of key messages, the key research findings that have made their way into the chapters in your book?
Well, I think the first message really is that we can't assume that even though many young people clearly have facility with digital technologies and are very keen to use them, we can't assume that they will naturally learn how to use the technologies to best support their learning. Just in the same way that we know from all the research on collaborative learning that it's most effective when there's been some support and tutoring in how to collaborate effectively, the same is also true for learning using technologies. So I think the notion of the digital native is quite a dangerous one, because if we assume that we don't need to teach youngsters how to use technology effectively, we often leave them apparently happily tinkering around for hours on end, but not actually getting very far. And one of the areas where this came through was in the study that we did of the BBC Blast community. Now, this was a very well-funded project set up through the BBC, specifically aimed at supporting young people to develop their creative skills in a range of arts areas. And it was very well designed, it had very good thought material, but in fact the students who made the most progress came to that not just independently, but in fact through media courses in schools and colleges that they were attending. And they tended to be the students who made the most effective use, because they had the support of their teachers, and they were more likely to also have gone to the physical roadshow events that the BBC ran to support the use of the online community. Whereas we saw very few young people who had spontaneously come to the communities and engaged in meaningful ways. And it's not so surprising when you think about it. I mean, we all know that there will be a far larger number of people who will simply view online material, and you get quite a hefty filter down to people who are then prepared to actually contribute. And if you then look at the number who contribute in a way that can genuinely start or engage in some kind of learning conversation, then that number drops even further. So it just underlines the fact that even where you have young people who are extremely familiar with digital communications and social media, they still need support, for the most part, in understanding how to use those tools to support their own learning. And the other thing that was quite interesting is that where we did find youngsters who appeared to have a facility significantly in advance of that of their classmates, it was usually because there was some support coming from home. They had somebody in the home who was very digitally adept, could support them in their use of their technologies, and they also tended to have friendship groups of high users as well, and effective users. So even where they didn't seem to be picking up this overt teaching in a formal classroom context, they were getting it elsewhere. So the idea that, you know, all you have to do is leave young people with powerful digital tools, and a phrase which I particularly dislike, have teachers get out of the way, which you will find in some authors talking about, actually it's very unusual for youngsters to really maximise the benefits of the digital tools. And the few that do, it's usually because they're getting support from other sources. It doesn't happen spontaneously.
Hi, Angela. This is John Johnson here. I get it. The idea you're talking about seems to be it's not so much the digital tools that pupils need, it's with learning. And I'm just wondering, how comfortable do you think the teachers need to be with the digital tools to support the learning?
Well, I think there are two layers to both the digital competence, which is a word that colleagues in Scandinavia use, and I think it's quite a helpful one. And there are two distinct aspects to it, and they are closely related, but they are different. One is in the actual facility to operate the tools themselves. So we would find youngsters, for example, who could never find work that they saved, for example. Mm. They just hadn't learned that basic piece of the digital jigsaw. So they clearly need some support in basics of just how to work with digital content. And similarly with teachers, you do really need to be sufficiently confident in the basic use of the technology so that you're not wasting time and getting frustrated in a classroom context because you can't find the students' work either. So there is a need for that. But what we are seeing increasingly is that teachers actually have quite good basic digital skills. But of course, it's very difficult to know now, in England anyway, what the picture really is, because unfortunately, we no longer have the benefit of the really excellent annual surveys that the Department for Education used to do, which gave us a very clear picture and particularly showed trends very clearly in just how effective teachers were in their use of the technology. And at the point at which those surveys stopped, which is a good few years ago now, there was an upward trend. But the honest answer, I think, is that nobody really knows the extent to which teachers in the classroom are comfortable with technology. And there does tend to be an assumption that the average teacher is not comfortable. And I don't think that's reasonable or fair. My guess would be is that it's a very mixed picture, but that there are a lot of teachers now who are very comfortable and confident in their own use of quite a range of digital technologies and social media. But of course, it will vary, and it's always dangerous to generalise.
Do you think that these teachers who are comfortable, and I'm guessing that part of my career has been supporting teachers in the classroom with technology, and sometimes I'm struck by the fact that people who are maybe reluctant to use the technology in the classroom, and you pop in for a cup of coffee in the staff room and they're on a mobile device on Facebook or something like this, and it's almost like they're comfortable with the technology, but they haven't put that together with classroom use.
Well, let's just step back for a second and ask why that might be. I don't know if you come across the very helpful publication that Nesta produced, written by Michael Fullan and Karen Donnelly. And they made the point, which is kind of the elephant in the room, really, that people don't like to admit to, that the first necessity for uptake of digital technologies in the classroom is that the technology itself has got to be robust and reliable. And in fact, the phrase that Fullan and Donnelly use is delightful to use. Now, how many times, John, and you don't have to answer this rhetorically, you can treat it as a rhetorical question if you like, how many times have you been into a school to work with a teacher and the technology does not perform at the level that you really require for it not to interrupt the smooth running of a lesson?
Oh, yeah. I'll answer that quite straightforwardly. Lots, I think, would be the answer.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's not surprising that what usage data we have got suggests that teachers are reluctant to use technology, particularly in the years when students are preparing for high-stakes examinations. Now, that they've also got the added issue that of the potential mismatch between the kind of learning that you're doing when you use technology and the kind of learning that you're going to be tested on when you sit a paper and pencil exam. That's an added problem. But, I was having an interesting conversation with a colleague the other day about, for those of us who had to stand in front of a year nine on a wet and windy Friday afternoon, it kind of sets you apart from the people who've never had to do that. And those of us who've done it know that the last thing you need when you're trying to maintain the pace and the engagement of learners is for the wretched technology to get in the way. And I still believe that that is a major barrier to meaningful use of technology in schools by a lot of teachers. Excuse me. I think they make a valid professional judgment about their choice not to employ technology quite frequently on that basis.
Yeah, I don't think I could argue with that, because I've been in the situation quite a lot of times when things haven't worked. And if you're faced with that frequently, I suppose it gets a bit off-putting. I'm kind of interested as well in the title of your book, and I think a title of a book that you put together before, which I just found in my bookshelf last night, which was... I can't remember the title, Technology and Authentic Learning in the Primary School. I'm from a primary background. And it's, I wonder, could you tease out a wee bit about what you mean by authentic learning?
Well, in both cases, I've deliberately chosen that term, authentic learning, which I've used in the sense, which is not unique to me, but I've used it in the sense of learning which has genuine meaning for the individual who is doing the learning. So it has relevance and validity. And what I'm getting at here, in part, is that I do think that when we're educating young people to be socially and ultimately economically active in the current world, that there needs to be an authenticity, i.e. a personal relevance, to the kind of learning that we're supporting them to do. And my concern is that much of the learning that they're doing in school currently is not perhaps the best preparation for what they do outside school and what they do after school, i.e. Yeah. post-school.
Yeah, that's... I've been challenged a few times on using the word sort of real with scare quotes around it, usually when you talk about pupils maybe producing something that will have an audience of outside the classroom, for instance, and I guess that's, or I hope that would be tending towards some sort of authenticity.
Certainly that's an element of it. I mean, and of course it is one of the potential benefits of a connected world, that it is possible for students to produce work that has an audience beyond the classroom. Even in fact, in the first instance, if that audience is their own friends and family. And one of the things that came through when we were using the mobile devices with the primary school students was that parents started to tell us that kids were coming home, and when they ask them what they've done in school today, instead of the usual kind of shrug of the shoulders and all, not much or nothing, they'd get out their device and they'd start to show parents what they've been doing. And this was this was quite a revolution for some of the youngsters. And now, looking back on that, excuse me, through the lens of a recent OECD report that showed that any kind of family engagement in learners' school experience, even things as simple as having a short conversation about what was happening in school that day, is one of the things that can really break the apparently impossible to reverse link between socioeconomic background and eventual educational outcome. So there is the possibility there that by using, either through using a device or possibly web-based repository for children's work, it increases the chances of there being some kind of conversation in the family context about the work that's done at school. My hunch is that having the work on a device will likely be more potent, because that whole sense of ownership is very strong. And whipping a little device out of your bag and showing some work is clearly a much easier and straightforward process than firing up a computer and logging onto the school learning network. So I suspect it would be more likely to happen with a personal device.
And Angela, John mentioned the primary book, the Authentic Learning book from, I think, 1997 that's on his bookshelf. And I'm just wondering what was it kind of envisaged back then in terms of the devices has changed somewhat. I think there's a line in your new book that kind of alludes to this, that the learning technologists, the education technologists, you know, 15, 20 years ago, weren't expecting things to turn out the way that they have, and has that caught us off guard somewhat?
Well, it was really interesting, because what actually spurred me to do the latest book was that in the space of just a few months, I met three people, or each of whom, it just so happened, had recently been using the old book. And they were very polite about it. And in fact, they were very complimentary about it, which was very nice of them. But I was so embarrassed to think that book was still being used when it was so old that I thought, I really do need to get a wiggle on here and get a new updated book out. And when I came to do that, two things struck me. The first is the point you're alluding to, David, that really none of the pundits at that time predicted social media, and they didn't they haven't really predicted Web 2.0. I mean, there'll always be the odd. Ted Nelson will tell you that when he came up with the idea of hypertext, he actually imagined all of these. But most people were not talking about these things. So that was the first thing that struck me. But the second thing that struck me was how much of what I was saying in that book, which is 15 years ago, a bit more actually, in fact still held true. So this issue about there still being difficulties with reliable access in school, that's as much an issue now as it ever was. The other thing that's also problematic is the mismatch between the kinds of learning that we're prepared to give people credit for in high-stakes assessment and the broader, more productive approach to knowledge building, which is really what you need when you're trying to create sense in a world where you're bombarded with information constantly, and where you have almost infinite, in fact, to all intents and purposes, you do have infinite access to information. And those two things, I think, are just as problematic, arguably more so, because back then, when I was working on that book, we were just on the cusp of the real explosion in internet access. So most schools were, they did have access to large databases on CD-ROM, which of course back in the day, you know, we thought was pretty amazing. And it was, to be fair, pretty amazing. But obviously that was quite finite and contained compared to the amount of information that you'll get returned from a standard search engine these days. So in some cases, it's a question of scale, but the whole issue of connectedness in social media, of course, was not predicted or addressed at all. And I do think this is an area where we do need to be thinking very, very carefully about extending the kind of socialization which a school would expect to do in young people's development of their face-to-face interactions with other people. We need to develop that to also cover the way in which they interact with others online. Because without that, I think we're unlikely to see a decrease in the current levels of socially unacceptable behaviours that young people are subjected to online, in some cases on a daily basis.
I wonder, Angela, just on that point, I have a couple other questions, but just on that point, when I was a few years ago in school and I was encouraging children to post to blogs and things, I always argued that this was a good idea because it gave us a sort of sandbox or safe playground for, and I say safe in a loose-ish way, a safe playground that paralleled the sort of school playground. It was somewhere they could go out and they would be on the internet, and if they did daft things, we were there to address it and talk it through with them and work through with them, rather than, you know, sort of blocking and banning these things in the classroom. Do you think that more classrooms more need to engage online, actively publishing and to give children experiences so they can actually teach this?
I do, and I think there needs to be a carefully negotiated contract between schools and parents so that parents understand that this is what's happening. because the research evidence suggests that even where parents are very, very aware and use the various controls available to them to afford some protection to their youngsters when they're online out of school, that actually they're still not sufficient to fully protect young people. Now, again, it's very difficult to know quite what the level of let's just call it antisocial behaviour as a catch-all. But looking at a number of research reports in the English-speaking world, they do seem to have a remarkable degree of similarity in their data. So it's looking as though about 20% of young people get a message of some kind which they find upsetting each day. Now, you have to hope it's not the same 20% every day, but that still means that an unacceptably high number of children and young people are being subjected to behaviours which in any other context would clearly be socially unacceptable. The other side of this, of course, is that a very similar percentage are actually sending messages which they know to be unacceptable, and effectively bullying. Now, bullying is an age-old problem that schools have had to face. And unfortunately, online behaviours are replicating offline behaviours in this regard. But where you have bullying happening digitally, there is at least some evidence. You know, we've all had difficulties with managing behaviour where you're in a situation where one child says one thing and another child says another, and they, you know, they don't agree with one another, and it can be very difficult to resolve. But if there is digital evidence, at least you know what is being said or sent. You may not be able to trace who has sent it, but I suspect in quite a few cases you can. And so it seems to me that there is at least a potential here for being able to nip things in the bud. But of course that depends on there being a culture of openness in the school where youngsters feel they have somebody, an adult, a responsible adult in the school that they can go to when they have these kinds of problems. But then that's the same as you would hope to engender for young people facing any kind of difficulty in school. So I think the situation is far from easy, but it's also far from hopeless. And I, you know, I'm very well aware of the growing number of things that schools and teachers are expected to deal with. But I think any school would recognise the important role it plays in socialising young people. Mm. And they and many, many schools are doing good work in extending that into the digital domain. And I think that's they're a good example. And there are good support services out there, and I do point to a couple of the ones that I think were particularly leading edge in the book.
Angela, to me, the book's very much aimed at would be very helpful to, you know, to student teachers or those just entering their first employment within the teaching profession. Am I right in that regard? And is it also aimed, you know, I'm wondering how you actually conclude the book. You know, you've illustrated a number of concerns that are couched in as you say, long-term, long-scale studies. So do you put forward a kind of political agenda at all within the book, or is it more about asking in service and student teachers, etc., to reflect more on their practice with a bit of help from the research?
Well, each chapter in the book is actually quite self-contained. And yes, I did have the less experienced teacher in mind when I was writing it. Partly because I always assume that I'm in no position to teach experienced teachers anything. But actually, it's been quite surprising the number of people who've read it, who are very experienced educators and actually have found the findings from our longitudinal studies quite illuminating. So I hope there is something in here in the book for anyone, no matter what stage they're at in their teaching career. But the forward, the forward look at the end of the book is primarily aimed at those who are thinking about the assessment agenda. Because I do feel that the assessment agenda globally is shifting. We've already seen the collaborative learning the problem-based learning in a computer-based environment coming into PISA. The next thing that they're working on is an assessment of collaborative problem-solving in a computer-based environment. And I think that is a very clear indicator of the way in which global educational policy is moving. And I think the UK needs to be looking very much to that agenda and asking whether or not we are, in fact, preparing our young people as adequately as we could to be economically and socially successful in a very digital world. And I've been very privileged to be given the opportunity to spend Thursday and Friday this week with the Northern Future Forum, the Northern European Nordic and Baltic states, at a summit of education and technology specialists. So I'm looking forward to learning a lot about what's happening particularly in Nordic countries, which I think in some ways are slightly ahead of us on that particular agenda.
Angela, I'm just wanting to maybe go back to the bit about, you know, the access to technology. And we've seen, I mean, I've observed a couple of small one-to-one pilots with kit that pupils take home, and seen some of the things that you talk about with the engagement with parents especially. But one of the things that some people in Scotland are now trying, and I guess in lots of other places, is the BYOD sort of initiative in encouraging children to bring in their own equipment into school. And given our kind of economic constraints, do you see that as coming any way to meet the sort of dearth of solid connections and reliable equipment?
Well, I have actually, for at least a couple of decades, been looking at the whole personal ownership issue. And I have long believed that the necessary levels of equipment in schools for every student to have access to a device whenever it's appropriate will never come from central resourcing. That we will only ever get there when we have a mixed economy of children and young people bringing their own devices and the school providing specialists equipment. So, for example, you could imagine that for basic online content access and production, you might be using your own device from home. But if you want a highly processor intensive, let's say 3D graphics package, then that's something that would be on specialist equipment that the school provided. So I think ultimately that will have to be the model. Now, smartphones will get you so far. They are very good and increasingly good at getting high-speed access to content. They're still pretty limited in terms of production of content. And one of the things that concerns me about some of the tablet projects that I see is that the tablets are being used almost exclusively for content consumption. And whilst that's very powerful, real learning requires learners to produce representations of their own understanding of what they're learning. You know, it's why we made children write essays. You know, it's why that productive part of the process has always been there. And we mustn't lose it or compromise it as we move from paper-based to more digital methods of working. We still need the tools that allow young people to produce their own powerful representations of how they see and interpret and understand the world. And of course, the wonderful thing about digital is that there are a range of media in which young people can now do that. But is there the recognition of the powerful content that they can produce? And more importantly, perhaps, is there the opportunity for them to produce that powerful content in a supportive, scaffolded environment, which increases their chances of that being a rich learning experience rather than just a fiddling around? And if you take video, for example, you see kids shooting hours and hours of digital video. But of course, shooting video, particularly randomly pointing cameras at things, might be a lot of fun. But the real learning comes in the careful editing and selection and presentation of that material in some kind of coherent form. And that's probably the bit that's not happened. So we've got potential here for youngsters to be using their own devices, as particularly as capture devices, but you do then need something that they can move on to do the powerful analysis and editing and synthesis of the content they've captured to produce something that really does represent their own understanding. And that's where the real power lies, in those iterative, productive tasks, where that's how, you know, if you want to know whether or not you understand something, try and create something that explains it to somebody else. And you'll soon discover how much you do and don't really understand about what you're doing.
That was a great wee bit there. I'm really interested in that. And as I was actually saying to the muted mic, as a kind of long-term blogger, I realise that very often you learn more by explaining something, or even failing to explain it properly, in my case, than you think. One of the interesting things I saw in watching a tablet one-to-one, and I think this is very much to do with the teacher encouraged the children to produce stuff, but what she did was do that in a way that the children had a choice of medium. And that seemed to me to be particularly powerful, that the children were definitely involved in more creation than consumption, I would say, but they kind of developed their own working methods of collaboration around the classroom. But the teacher was very clear that she wanted something accessible out of the end of it, but allowed them to go their own way, you know.
Well, this is where I'm really looking forward to seeing what PISA come up with for the assessment of collaborative problem solving. Because, of course, one of the great barriers to collaborative working in school is that high-stakes assessment is all based on individual performance. So there is always a worry that if learners are working together, how can you be sure which of them is actually doing what? And you can see why that would be a concern, particularly if you're working in a context where teachers are expected to show individual progression, not just on a termly basis, but perhaps even on a monthly basis. Excuse me. And given that one of the things that universities and employers are all crying out for is people who have better team working skills, you can see there's a natural tension between the demands that the school system is putting on teachers around the way they manage learning and what the world of work and further and higher education are looking for in terms of the skills that they want students to leave school with.
Yeah, I think just the last one on that is, I think in Scotland the curriculum for excellence is hopefully giving people a bit of a steer on this, and trying to maybe go away a bit from high stakes testing and more onto continuous assessment for learning. So maybe we'll get to a good place out of that. David,
if I could just in the last little time that we've got together, I would just like to say something, if I might, about the Claim Your College.
Yeah, really, Angela, I'm really looking forward to hearing this. I was in a past life chair of the Association of Chartered Teachers, and I've been in touch with many of your colleagues at the College of Teachers down the years, and always been very interested about moves towards a College of Teaching that may even be UK-wide. So I finally connected the hashtag with this movement, which is I know has been building ahead of steam. So take it away, Angela. Looking forward to hearing about this.
Well, the College of Teaching idea has been gathering momentum, certainly in England, since an Education Select Committee in 2012 suggested that the profession could be enhanced by having its own chartered professional organisation. and the current College of Teachers, who I joined in June, was for a large part of its history actually that organisation. But for various historical reasons, for the last 20 to 30 years, it hasn't played that role. But it is keen and eager to work now in collaboration with others to establish around a modified, revised, updated Royal Charter, a new College of Teaching. And we're working particularly closely at the moment with the Prince's Teaching Institute, who've done some fantastic preparatory work on this and produced their blueprint earlier on this year. And also the Teacher Development Trust, who are a relatively young, only I think just over 2 years old now, but very vibrant and very active development, which is really working closely with teachers and schools and being very effective in supporting development. So the idea of the Claim Your College campaign is that we really do now want to hear from the wider teaching community, because it's all very well for those of us, particularly those of us who are not in the classroom anymore, to sit round and talk about how we think such an entity might support teachers and their professional development. But ultimately, this can and should only happen if there is a critical mass of teachers out there who want this and want to work together to shape it. And there are a couple of things that a chartered professional body should help a profession to do. One of them is to agree a common code of practice, which all of the chartered institutes have. And by the chartered institutes, I mean everything through from things we call Royal Colleges of Medicine through to the chartered institutes of engineering and right the way through to things like in fact, one of the newer chartered institutes is the Chartered Institute of Marketers. So this idea of having a professional body wherein the profession itself sets its own standards of quality, of service and provision for the good of the general public is well established everywhere, it seems, when you look around, but not in teaching. The other thing that a college can do is provide a development pathway for a career in the profession. Because at the moment, we all know that if you want to progress your career in teaching, you can only really do that through moving into management. And there isn't a career structure that helps you to gain seniority through staying as a classroom teacher in the same way that you can for going to management. There are a number of things that the College of Teaching can do. Because unlike other professions, we seem to assume that as soon as people have been signed off from their NQT year, or whatever the equivalent of that is in a given school, that they're kind of fully formed and finished teachers. And yet, as with other professions, we actually all know that teachers carry on learning throughout their career. They get different levels of support to do that, and very often they don't get a great deal of recognition for having done that. A college is an entity that means that professional learning throughout your career can be recognised and celebrated, and people can be recognised for having made that development in their career through an equivalent of chartered status. But what will determine what a teacher should need to do and evidence in order to get their chartered status is a matter for the profession. And this is why we need people to join in the debate and to have their say and very much to make the college their own. So those of us who are working away on this, what we really want to do is to create an opportunity around which the profession, should it choose to, can actually congregate and form something collectively. And we don't need everybody to be involved from day one. Of course, there will be people who will be reluctant, who perhaps don't see its value at the outset. We hope we can ultimately, maybe 5 or 10 years down the line, convince them. But what we do need is a critical mass. Now, there have been 3 independent surveys by the Princeton Teaching Institute, by the Sutton Trust, and by the Times Educational Supplement. And they all came up with a very similar figure of about 40% of teachers who really thought this was a good idea and something that they would be prepared to pay an annual professional fee to be part of. Now, if we could create something that satisfies that desire for 40% of teachers, we would have a critical mass of the profession working together to improve the status and standing of teachers and create a meaningful career pathway for classroom teachers. And I, for one, think that that would be a fabulous thing to be able to help come about. As I say, it doesn't have to be everybody from the get-go. I think this is going to be something that will be a process of evolution, not revolution. But I think if we get it right, and if enough people contribute, we will get it right. They contribute their ideas and their expertise, we will get it right. It's something that could fundamentally change the culture of teaching and raise the status of the profession and be a genuine support and a recognition of the excellence and the hard work and the fantastic outcomes for learners that the majority of teachers achieve.
Well, Angela, best wishes with Claim Your College, and is the best piece of advice be to follow the hashtag? Or I know there's some blog posts and articles. I think there's a Bristol-based MP has been very supportive thus far. So where should people go to get involved in the conversation other than the hashtag?
Yeah, well, we've got 3 events. The first 3 of a series. We've got an event this Thursday in Bristol, which is our kickoff roadshow. And Charlotte Leslie, who's the MP you're referring to, has been great. She's been a real force of nature in the whole of this. And she's incredibly helpful because, as a politician, she can say in ways that the rest of us perhaps can't, that this needs to be a politics-free zone in terms of party politics anyway. That this is not something that politicians should be looking to legislate. In England, you know, that we had the unfortunate experience with the General Teaching Council, which was set up given an extraordinarily difficult remit and then summarily closed due to a policy change. One of the things that the Charter does is protect a professional body from that kind of political control. And Charlotte's been very vocal on this, that politicians need to, and I'll quote her, keep their mitts off a college. It does need to be something of the profession, for the profession. We've also got David Carter, recently an extremely successful head of the Cabot group of schools in Bristol, now the South West Schools Commissioner. We've got Professor Jonathan Shepherd, who is very active in the Royal College of Surgeons, so he's going to be giving a perspective from his profession's point of view. And we also have Matt Butler, a local head from the from one of the local schools, from the Oasis Brightstone Academy. And he will be giving very much a school perspective. Now, that's the first kickoff event. We will be live tweeting from it. And we will then roll forward to an event in London on the 17th and one in York on the 20th. So we hope to build up a question and answer bank to start capturing the questions and the comments that we're getting from the wider audience. We have got a blog, a very rudimentary one at the moment, but we're encouraging people, if they can't make one of the events, to contribute there. The blog is going through a process, a bit of a facelift. It's still active, but it will in a couple of weeks look a bit posher and be a bit more sophisticated. We've also got a blog space on the TES Connect space as well, if that's something that teachers find easier, if that's what they usually use. So we've got a few vehicles out there at the moment. And at the moment, it's about raising awareness, helping people understand what the issues are, directing them to what is now quite a lot of written thoughts and thinking about this, a special issue of the College of Teachers Education Today, which is on our website, a collection of papers edited by Charlotte Leslie and produced by with the support of the AQA, as well as the Princeton Teaching Institute blueprints are all out there for people who really want to get into the detail. We're not lacking material. But what we are working on in the Claim Your College campaign is a call to action. So we need to get all our ducks in a row before we can launch that. But as well as hearing what people think and raising their awareness of the issue, we will shortly be giving people an opportunity to get really involved in a meaningful way. So that's definitely one to look out for.
That's fantastic, Angela. Thanks for explaining the campaign and the process so far. And it certainly chimes with much of what went on in Scotland maybe a few years ago now, and sadly in many respects came to an end with the Chartered Teacher Programme. But I think there'll be many people, whether we're part of the kind of moves towards a master's level profession in Scotland or existing chartered teachers and others, and maybe involved in action research, etc., that will and career long professional learning, who will be very interested in following the story and may wish to get involved as well. So we'll leave it there. You've already given us much more time than we expected, Angela. Absolutely. On behalf of John and myself and listeners, thank you so much for appearing on Radio EduTalk. And if we get any tweets or emails in relating to what you had to speak about this evening, we'll be sure to pass them on.
Thank you very much, Dave. Yeah. Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Oh, great stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Angela. Thanks.